You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of the collection of essays that were introductions to Goethe's scientific writings by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Nature's Open Secret. This is Chapter 4, entitled The Nature and Significance of Goethe's Writings on Organic Morphology. Goethe's morphological works are so important because they establish the theoretical foundations and methodology for studying organic nature, a scientific accomplishment of the highest order. To properly appreciate this fact, we must above all consider the tremendous difference between inorganic and organic phenomena. The collision of two billiard balls, for example, is an inorganic phenomenon. If one ball is at rest and another strikes it from a certain direction with a certain velocity, the one at rest will begin to move in a certain direction with a certain velocity. We can comprehend such phenomena only by transforming what is given directly to the senses into concepts. We are able to do this to the extent that nothing sense-perceptible remains that we have not penetrated conceptually. We watch one ball approach and strike the other, and see the other move on. We have comprehended this phenomenon when, from the mass, direction, and velocity of the first ball, and from the mass of the second, we are able to predict the velocity and direction of the second. In other words, when we see that under given conditions, this phenomenon occurs with necessity. This, however, means only that what presents itself to our senses must appear as a necessary consequence of what we postulate as idea. If this is the case, then we can say that concept and phenomenon coincide. There is nothing in the concept that is not also in the phenomenon, and nothing in the phenomenon that is not also in the concept. Let us consider more closely the conditions that lead necessarily to an occurrence in inorganic nature. Here we encounter the significant fact that conditions determining sense-perceptible occurrences in inorganic nature also belong to the sensory world. In our example, mass, velocity, and direction come into consideration, conditions that, in fact, belong to the sensory realm. No other conditions determine the phenomenon. Only factors directly perceptible to the senses determine one another. A conceptual understanding of such occurrences thus simply deduces tangible reality from tangible reality. Spatial and temporal factors, mass, weight, or sense-perceptible forces such as light or warmth, all invoke phenomena belonging to the same category. A body is heated and thereby increases in volume. Both the cause and the effect, the heating as well as the expansion, belong to the sensory world. Thus, we do not have to go beyond the sensory world to grasp such occurrences. We simply deduce one phenomenon from another within that world. Therefore, when we wish to explain such a phenomenon and understand it conceptually, we need to include only those elements that can be perceived by the senses. Everything we wish to understand can be perceived. Therein lies the coincidence of percept, appearance, and concept. Nothing in such events remains obscure to us, because we know the conditions that led to them. Thus we have developed the essential nature of the inorganic world, and in doing so have shown the extent to which we can explain it through itself without going beyond it. There has never been any question about this since human beings first began to think about the nature of such things. They did not, of course, always follow the above course of reasoning that leads to the coincidence of concept and percept, but they never hesitated to explain phenomena through their own essential nature as indicated. Footnote: some philosophers maintain that although we can trace the phenomena of the sense world back to their original elements or forces, yet we can no more explain these than we can the essential nature of life. As to this, it must be remarked that those elements are simple, that is, they cannot themselves be composed of even simpler elements. but the impossibility of deriving them, explaining them in their simplicity, is not due to a limitation of our cognitive capacity, but to the fact that they rest upon themselves. They are present to us in all their immediacy. They are complete in themselves and cannot be derived from anything else. Rudolf Steiner, end of footnote. This was not true, however, with regard to phenomena in the organic realm until Goethe. The sense-perceptible aspects of the organism, its form, size, color, temperature, and so on, do not seem to be determined by the same kind of factors. One cannot say, for example, that the size, form, position, and so on of a plant's roots determine the sense-perceptible characteristics of the leaf or blossom. A body in which this were the case would not be an organism, but a machine. Rather, it must be granted that the sense-perceptible characteristics of a living being do not appear as a result of other sense-perceptible conditions, as in inorganic nature. Footnote. Herein lies the difference between organisms and machines. What is essential in the machine is only the interaction of its parts. The unifying principle that governs that interaction does not exist in the object itself, but outside it as a plan in the head of its builder. Only the most extreme short-sightedness can deny that the difference between an organism and a mechanism is precisely the fact that in a machine the determining principle governing the interrelationship of its parts is external and abstract, whereas in an organism it assumes a real existence in the object itself. Thus, the sense-perceptible conditions of an organism do not appear merely to follow one from another, but are governed by an inner principle that is imperceptible to the senses. In this sense, this principle is no more perceptible to the senses than the plan in the builder's head, which is also present only to the mind. Essentially, it is such a plan, except that it has entered the organism's inner being and affects it directly, not through a third party, the builder. Rudolf Steiner. End of footnote. Indeed, all sensory qualities arise in an organism as the result of something no longer perceptible to the senses. They appear as the result of a higher unity hovering over the sense-perceptible processes. It is not the form of the root that determines that of the stem, and not the form of the stem that determines that of the leaves, and so on. All of these forms are determined, instead, by something that exists above them, and whose form is inaccessible to the senses. The perceptible elements exist for one another, but not as a result of one another. They are not mutually determined by one another, but by something else. Here, what we perceive with our senses cannot be reduced to other sensorial factors. We must include in our concept of events elements that do not belong to the world of the senses. We must go beyond the sensory world. What we perceive is no longer enough. To comprehend the phenomena, we must gradually grasp the unifying principle. Consequently, however, a distance arises between percept and concept, and they no longer seem to coincide. The concept hovers over what is observed, and it becomes difficult to see how they are connected. Footnote: this apparent distance between the concept and percept of an organism is true of intellectual thinking that is geared to an inanimate world governed by material cause and effect. Focusing on the raw, bodily nature of an organism, such thinking cannot see any connection to an inner principle that informs the whole. To such an intellectual consciousness, therefore, this inner principle or concept appears to hover above the sense-perceptible organism. It is different for intuitive thinking, in which external particulars appear as immediate expressions of an inner principle. How intuitive thinking comprehends organic nature is explained in the following pages. Editor, end of footnote. Whereas concept and sensory reality were one in inorganic nature, they seem to diverge here and belong, in fact, to two different worlds. What is perceived and presents itself directly to the senses no longer seems to bear its own explanation or essence within itself. The object does not seem to be self-explanatory, because its concept is taken from something other than itself. Because the object is present to the senses, but does not seem to be governed by the laws of the sensory world, it is as though we were confronted by an insoluble contradiction in nature. It is as though there were a gulf between inorganic phenomena, which are self-explanatory, and organic beings, where natural laws are intruded upon and legitimate laws seem suddenly to be broken. This chasm was in fact generally taken for granted in science, until Goethe, who succeeded in solving this mystery. Until then, it was assumed that only inorganic nature could be explained through itself. The human capacity for knowledge was believed to end at the level of organic nature. We can comprehend the magnitude of Goethe's achievement when we consider the fact that Kant, the great reformer of recent philosophy, not only shared that old, erroneous concept fully, but even sought for a scientific reason why the human mind would never be able to explain organic entities. He did, in fact, acknowledge the possibility of an intuitive intellect, parenthesis intellectus archetypus, close quote, or close parenthesis, capable of grasping the connection between concept and sensory reality, both in organic beings and in the inorganic realm, but he denied humankind the possibility of such an intellect. According to Kant, the human intellect can conceive of the unity or concept of a thing only as arising from the interaction of its parts, as an analytical generalization arrived at through abstract reasoning, but not in such a way that each part appears as the result of a definite, concrete, or synthetic unity, that is, as the result of an intuitive concept. Consequently, he considered it impossible for the human intellect to explain organic nature, the activity of which must be viewed as emanating from the whole into the parts. Kant said, quote, "Thus our intellect has this peculiarity with regard to our power of judgment, namely, that in cognition by it, the particulars are not determined by the universal, and cannot therefore be derived from it alone." Critique of Judgment, paragraph 77, end of footnote, or excuse me, end of quote. According to this, when studying organic entities, we would have to give up the possibility of knowing the necessary relationship between the idea of the whole, which can only be thought, and what appears to our senses in space and time. According to Kant, we would have to be content with knowing that such a relationship exists, but we could not satisfy the demand of our logical thinking to know how the general thought or idea steps out of itself and manifests as sensory reality. We would have to assume, instead, that concept and sensory reality confront each other without mediation, having been brought about by an influence external to both, such as when a person assembles some composite object, say a machine, according to an idea. Thus, any possibility of explaining the organic world was denied. In fact, its impossibility seemed to be proven. This was the situation when Goethe began to devote himself to the organic sciences. He came to these studies, however, after having prepared himself most appropriately by repeatedly reading Spinoza's philosophy. Goethe first took up Spinoza in the spring of 1774. In titled Poetry and Truth, he wrote about his initial encounter with this philosopher, quote, "After searching the world in vain for a way to educate my extraordinary being, I finally came upon this man's title, Ethics," close quote. During the summer of that same year, Goethe met with Fritz Jacobi, who was studying Spinoza at the time, as shown by his letters of 1785 about Spinoza's teachings. Jacobi was just the person to lead Goethe more deeply into the nature of that philosopher. They discussed Spinoza a great deal at that point, since for Goethe, quote, everything was still having its first effects and counter-effects, fermenting and churning, close quote. Sometime later, he discovered in his father's library a book by an author who viciously attacked Spinoza, and indeed distorted him to the point of complete caricature. Goethe's response was to again seriously study this profound thinker. In Spinoza's writings, he found the key to the deepest scientific questions he was capable of asking at the time. In 1784, the poet read Spinoza with Frau von Stein, and on November 4th he wrote to her, quote, I am bringing along Spinoza in Latin, in which everything is much clearer, close quote. The philosopher had a tremendous effect on Goethe, who was always quite outspoken in acknowledging this fact. In 1816 he wrote to Zelter, quote, except for Shakespeare and Spinoza, I do not know of any departed soul who has affected me as much as Luna, close quote. He therefore regarded Shakespeare and Spinoza as the two who had the greatest influence on him. We see most clearly how this influence manifested in his morphological studies when we consider what he had to say about Lavater in his title Italian Journey. Lavater maintained the prevalent view that a living organism can only arise through an influence not inherent in its own nature, through the violation of universal natural laws. Goethe wrote, quote, recently I found these silly words in a pitifully apostolic and monkish declamation by the prophet of Zurich, everything that has life lives through something outside itself. At least it sounded something like that. Now, this is just what such a missionary to the heathen might write, and no genius tugs at his sleeve as he does so. From Italian Journey, October 5, 1787, end of quote. This was entirely in the spirit of Spinoza. Spinoza distinguishes three kinds of knowledge. The first occurs as we hear or read certain words. We remember the things referred to, and form mental images of them like those we generally use to picture things to ourselves. In the second kind of knowledge, we create general concepts from our adequately formed mental pictures of the characteristics of things. In the third kind of knowledge, we advance from an adequate image of the actual nature of certain attributes of God to an adequate knowledge of the essential nature of things. Now, Spinoza calls this kind of knowledge scientia intuitiva, or knowledge in beholding. It was this highest kind of knowledge that Goethe strove toward. Let us be clear about what Spinoza meant when he said that things should be known in such a way that in their essential nature we recognize certain attributes of God. Spinoza's God is the idea content of the world, the driving, all-supporting, all-sustaining principle. Now, we can imagine this by postulating that principle is a being that is independent and exists for itself, isolated from the finite world and maintaining itself apart from finite beings, while governing and animating them. On the other hand, we can conceive of this being as having entered the finite world, no longer abiding above and alongside temporal things, but existing only within them. This view in no way denies that primordial principle, but fully acknowledges it. However, it views this principle as having been poured out into the world. The first view sees the finite world as a revelation of the infinite. But this infinitude remains within its own being and relinquishes none of itself. It never goes beyond itself, but remains as it was before its revelation. The second view also sees the finite world as a manifestation of the infinite. It assumes, however, that this infinite being, by manifesting, has gone entirely beyond itself. that it has laid its own being and life into its creation, and now exists only in that creation. Now, since knowledge is clearly a perception of the essence of things, and since this essence exists only in the degree that it participates as a finite being in the primal principle of all things, thus knowing means perceiving the infinite in things. Footnote, that is, certain attributes of God within them. Rudolf Steiner, end of footnote. Before Goethe, it was indeed assumed, as we have described above, that inorganic nature could be explained through itself, that it contains its own explanation and its own nature within itself, but that this was not the case with organic nature. Here, the essential nature, or being, that manifests in the object could not be found within the object itself. Consequently, it was assumed to exist outside the object. In other words, organic nature was explained according to the first view, and inorganic nature according to the second. As we have seen, Spinoza proved the necessity of a unified knowledge. He was too much the philosopher, however, to demonstrate this theoretical insight in the various specialized branches of organic science. This task remained for Goethe, whose unwavering adherence to Spinoza's views is demonstrated not only by the statements quoted, but by many others as well. Entitled Poetry and Truth, he wrote, quote, "Nature works according to eternal, immutable laws, so divine that the Godhead itself can alter nothing in them." Close quote, from Part 4, Book 16. Referring to a book by Jacobi, published in 1811, titled Of Divine Things and Their Revelation, Goethe remarked, quote, "How could I welcome the book of such a dearly loved friend, and after finding that it developed the thesis that nature conceals God? With my pure, profound, inborn, and practiced way of contemplating things, which had taught me above all to see God in nature and nature in God, so that this way of thinking formed the foundation of my whole existence, must not such a strange, one-sidedly limited assertion forever estrange me spiritually from this noblest of men, whose heart I have revered and loved?" Close quote. Footnote from Tag und Jahreshefte, 1811, Rudolf Steiner, and a footnote. Goethe knew full well that the step he was taking had far-reaching significance for science. He realized that by breaking down the boundary between inorganic and organic nature, and thus advancing Spinoza's thinking, he was significantly changing the direction of science. That recognition is expressed in his essay, quote, "Judgment through Intuitive Perception," close quote. Goethe expressed his opposition after noting Kant's attempt, entitled Critique of Judgment, to prove the inability of the human intellect to explain an organism, quote, "It is true that the author seems to refer here to a divine intellect. However, if in fact we seek in the moral sphere, through faith in God, virtue, and immortality, to raise ourselves up into a higher realm, and to approach the primal being, then may we not also in the intellectual sphere, through the contemplation of an ever-creating nature, make ourselves worthy of spiritual participation in her productions? Since I had, after all, ceaselessly pressed on, at first unconsciously and out of an inner urge, toward the archetypal, the typical, since I had even succeeded in demonstrating how it unfolds in accordance with the laws of nature, there was nothing to stop me now from boldly embarking on the adventure of reason, as the sage of Königsberg himself called it." Close quote. This is the essential thing, an occurrence in inorganic nature, that is, something that takes place only in the sensory world, is caused and determined by a process that likewise occurs only in the sensory world. Imagine that the causal process consists of elements M, D, and V, mass, direction, and velocity, of a moving billiard ball, and the resulting process of elements M prime, D prime, and V prime. Whenever M, D, and V are given, M prime, D prime, and V prime will be determined by them. If I wish to understand this occurrence, I must formulate the entire event, consisting of cause and effect, with one concept that includes both. But this kind of concept cannot exist within the occurrence itself and determine it. It encompasses both processes in a common expression, but it does not cause or determine. Only the objects of the sensory world determine one another. The elements M, D, and V are also perceptible to the outer senses. The concept in this case simply serves to summarize the external event. It expresses something that is not real as an idea or concept, but is real to the senses. This, in quotes, something it expresses is an object of sensory perception. Knowledge of inorganic nature is based on the possibility of comprehending the external world through the senses and expressing its interactions through concepts. Kant regarded the possibility of knowing things in this way as the only kind of knowledge accessible to the human being. He called this kind of thinking discursive. What we wish to know is an external perception. The concept, or combining unity, is merely a means. Let me read that last sentence again. What we wish to know is an external perception. The concept, or combining unity, is merely a means. If, however, we wish to comprehend organic nature, then according to Kant, we cannot apprehend the ideal, conceptual aspect as something that borrows its meaning by expressing or indicating something else. Rather, we would have to apprehend the ideal element as such. It would have to contain its own meaning, stemming from itself, not from the spatial temporal world of the senses. The unity that our mind merely abstracts in the case of the inorganic would have to build upon itself, forming itself out of itself. It would have to be fashioned according to its own being, not according to the influences of other objects. According to Kant, the comprehension of such a self-forming and self-manifesting entity is denied to the human being. What is needed to attain such comprehension? We need a kind of thinking that can give a thought a substance not derived from outer sensory perception. A thinking that comprehends not only what is perceived externally by the senses, but also apprehends pure ideas apart from the sensory world. A concept that is not abstracted from the sensory world, but whose content develops out of itself, and only out of itself, can be called an intuitive concept, and the comprehension of such a concept may be called intuitive knowledge. What follows from this is clear. A living organism can be comprehended only through an intuitive concept. Goethe actually demonstrated that it is in fact possible for us to know in this way. The inorganic world is governed by the interaction of the individual elements comprising an event, by the reciprocal way they determine one another. This is not true of the organic world, where one member of an organism does not determine another, but where the whole or idea determines each particular out of itself in accordance with its own being. In referring to this self-determined entity, we can follow Goethe's terminology and call it an entelechy. An entelechy, therefore, is a force that calls itself into being. The resulting manifestations have sensory existence, but they are determined by this entelechial principle. This creates an apparent contradiction. The organism is self-determining and creates its characteristics out of itself according to a postulated principle, and yet it has sense-perceptible reality. An organism thus attains sense-perceptible reality in a way that is completely different from the other objects of the sensory world. Consequently, it seems to arise unnaturally. It is also entirely understandable that externally an organism is exposed to the effects of the sensory world, as is any other body. A tile falling from the roof can strike a living creature as well as an inorganic object. An organism is related to the outer world through its intake of nourishment and so on. It is affected by the physical circumstances of the outer world. This can, of course, occur only to the degree that the organism is an object of the spatial-temporal world of the senses. This object of the outer world, the entelechial principle that has manifested outwardly, is the external appearance of the organism. Consequently, it seems neither to fully accord with itself nor to adhere strictly to its own nature. But since the organism is subject not only to its own formative laws, but to conditions of the outer world as well, since it is not only as it should be according to its own self-determining entelechial principle, but also what it has become through the influence of other factors upon which it depends, it never seems to fully accord with itself, nor to adhere strictly to its own nature. This is where human reason enters, and within the realm of ideas, develops an organism that corresponds only to its own principle, setting aside the influences from the outer world. Every incidental influence that has nothing to do with the organic as such thus falls away completely. This idea, which corresponds purely to the organic aspect of the organism, is the archetypal organism. It is Goethe's type. Thus the eminent validity of the idea of the type becomes apparent. It is not merely an intellectual concept, but the truly organic aspect of every organism, without which it would not be an organism. Because it manifests in every organism, it is more real than any actual particular organism. It also expresses the essence of an organism more fully and purely than any individual organism in particular. The way we arrive at the idea of the type is fundamentally different from the way we arrive at a concept of an inorganic process, which is abstracted from external reality and is not active within it. The idea of the organism, on the other hand, works actively within the organism as its entelechy. It is the essence of the entelechy itself in a form apprehended by our reason. The idea is not a summary of experience. It produces experience. Goethe expresses this as follows, quote, "A concept is the sum of experience. An idea is its result. To understand a concept requires intellect. To comprehend an idea requires reason." Close quote. This explains the kind of reality that must be attributed to Goethe's archetypal organism, the archetypal plant or animal. This Goethean method is clearly the only way we can apprehend the essential nature of the organic world. Footnote. Here, Steiner introduces a new concept of scientific method. The distinction he makes here between concept and idea has important consequences, particularly for the methodology of organic science. The dynamic, living idea of the type leads research along a very different path and to a very different result than do the analytical methods of inorganic science. Grasping the idea of the type requires a different quality of thinking, here called reason, or in the following, judgment through intuitive perception, which is essential to Goethe's method of organic science. It is only this kind of active, participatory thinking that can apprehend the type in its various metamorphoses. Thus, exact participatory thinking becomes the method of organic science. This method is discussed in the section on Goethe in the concluding essay of this volume, and in Henri Bortoff, titled The Wholeness of Nature, Goethe's Way Toward a Science of Conscious Participation in Nature. Editor. End of footnote. Within the inorganic realm, we must realize the essential circumstance that the phenomenon, in its multiplicity, is not the same as the lawfulness that explains it, but merely points to this lawfulness as to something external to it. The relationship between what we perceive, the material element in our knowledge given through the outer senses, and the concept, or formal means of recognizing the necessity of what we perceive, is their objective need of each other. But this relationship is such that the concept does not live in the particulars of an experienced event, but in the interrelationship of those particulars. This interrelationship, which combines the multiplicity into a unified whole, is based on the particulars of the given, but as a whole or unity it does not actually manifest concretely. Only the particulars of that relationship manifest in outer existence, in the object. The unity or concept as such manifests only in our intellect, whose task is to combine the multiplicity of the phenomena. The concept is related to this multiplicity as its sum. Here we are dealing with a duality, the manifold phenomena we perceive and the unity we think. In organic nature, the diverse particulars of an organism do not have such an external relationship to one another. The unity manifests in what is perceived. It comes into existence together with the diversity and is identical with it. The relationship between the individual members of a phenomenal whole, an organism, has become a reality and manifests concretely, no longer only in our intellect, but in the object as well, where it produces multiplicity out of itself. The concept does not merely play the role of a summarizing element with its object outside itself. It has united with its object completely. The object of our perception is no longer different from the concept through which we think it. We perceive that concept itself as idea. Footnote: we see the concept or idea as it manifests in the organism itself. Editor and a footnote. Therefore, Goethe calls the capacity through which we grasp organic nature judgment through intuitive perception. That which explains the formal element in our knowledge, the concept, and that which is explained, the material element or percept, are identical. The idea through which we comprehend the organic is therefore essentially different from the concept through which we explain the inorganic. It does not merely combine a given multiplicity, like a summary, but brings forth its own content out of itself. It is the result of the given of experience. It is concrete appearance. Footnote: thus, for example, the concept of a clock does not express itself directly through its parts, but can be comprehended only through an intellectual understanding of their interactions and purpose. Here, the unity or purpose does not manifest directly through the parts. In an organism, this is different. The formation of every organ of an animal, for example, and every aspect of its behavior, are direct expressions of its essential nature, or idea. This idea can be perceived directly and enlivened and deepened through experience. In this sense, it is the result of experience. Editor, end of footnote. This is why in inorganic science we speak of laws, natural laws, and use them to explain the facts, whereas in organic science we use types. A law is not the same as the perceived multiplicity it governs, but stands above it. In the type, however, the ideal and the real have united. The multiplicity can only be explained as arising from a point within the whole, with which it is identical. The significant aspect of Goethe's research is its insight into this relationship between inorganic and organic science. It is wrong, therefore, to say, as it often is today, that Goethe's science anticipated a kind of monism whose goal is a unified view of nature that encompasses the organic and the inorganic by reducing the organic to the same principles, mechanical and physical categories and laws, used to determine inorganic nature. We have seen how Goethe conceived of a monistic view. His method of explaining the organic was fundamentally different from his approach to the inorganic realm. Whenever principles of a higher nature were involved, he wanted to see mechanistic explanations strictly rejected. Footnote, quote, "We see significant things assembled in parts. Consider the works of architecture. We see how many things arise in a regular or irregular fashion through agglomeration. Therefore, atomistic concepts are very convenient, and we do not shy away from applying them in cases involving organic life. For it is just when one pushes aside problems that can only be explained dynamically that mechanical ways of explaining again become the order of the day." Close quote from Verses in Prose, and this is Rudolf Steiner, footnote, end of footnote. He criticized Kieser and Linck for wanting to trace organic phenomena back to inorganic causes. This mistaken view of Goethe arose because of the position he took toward Kant concerning the possibility of comprehending organic nature. When Kant asserts that our intellect cannot explain living organisms, he does not mean that they are determined by mechanical laws, and that he is unable to grasp them as stemming from physical or mechanical categories. According to Kant, the reason for this inability lies precisely in the fact that our intellect can explain only what is physical-mechanical, and that the essential being of an organism is not of that nature. If it were so, the intellect could easily comprehend it through the categories at its command. Goethe, of course, was not trying to contradict Kant by expounding a mechanical view of the organic world. His point was that we certainly do not lack the ability to grasp a higher form of generative activity that is the essence of organic nature. When we consider what was just said, we quickly encounter an important difference between inorganic and organic nature. Since in inorganic nature, any process can cause another, and that in turn another, and so on, the series of occurrences never seems to complete itself. Everything is open to continued interaction without any one particular group of objects being able to close itself off from the influence of others. Chains of inorganic events do not begin or end. There is only an incidental relationship between one event and the next. If a stone falls to the earth, its effect depends coincidentally on the kind of object it strikes. In an organism, this is very different. Here, the unity is the primary factor. The self-sustaining entelechy comprises a number of sense-perceptible developmental forms, one of which must be first and another last, and among which one follows another only in a specific way. The ideal unity produces a series of sense-perceptible organs over time and in a certain spatial relationship. It closes itself off in a very definite way from the rest of nature and produces its various states out of itself. These can, therefore, be grasped only by following the formation of successive states proceeding from an ideal unity. In other words, an organism can be comprehended only in its becoming, in its development. An inorganic body is finished and fixed. It is inwardly immobile and can be moved only from outside. An organism is never at rest. It is constantly reshaping itself from within outward, transforming and creating metamorphoses. Thus Goethe stated, quote, "Reason finds its field of activity in what is becoming, the intellect in what is finished. Reason does not bother to ask, what for? The intellect does not ask, where from? Reason delights in ongoing development. The intellect tries to hold everything fast so that it can put it to use. Reason governs only the living, the world that has already come to be. The concern of geology is dead." Let me read that last part again. "Reason governs only the living, the world that has already come to be. The concern of geology is dead." From Verses in Prose, end of quote. The organism presents itself to us in nature in two main forms, as plant and as animal, each in a different way. The plant distinguishes itself from the animal through its lack of any real inner life. In an animal, this inner life manifests as sensation, intentional movement, and so on. The plant has no such soul principle. It does not go beyond the development of its external form. As the entelechial principle unfolds its formative activity out of one point, so to speak, it manifests in the plant through the fact that each organ is shaped according to a common formative principle. The entelechy appears here as the force that forms the individual organs. The organs are all shaped according to one formative type, and they appear as the modifications of one fundamental organ. They are repetitions of that organ at various developmental levels. What makes the plant a plant, a particular formative force, is active in every organ in the same way. In this sense, each organ is identical with all the others and also with the plant as a whole. Goethe expressed it this way, quote, "I have come to realize that the organ of the plant we ordinarily call the leaf conceals the true Proteus, who can conceal and reveal himself in all formations. Backward and forward, the plant is only leaf, linked so inseparably to the future seed that one should not think one without the other." Italian Journey, May 17, 1787, included in Report of July 1787. Close quote. Thus the plant appears to be made up of many individual plants, so to speak, like a complex individual made up of less complex individuals. The development of the plant progresses from stage to stage and forms its organs. Each organ is identical to every other in its formative principle, though different in appearance. The plant's inner unity spreads itself into outer breadth. It expresses and loses itself in diverse forms, so that it does not, as it does in the animal, attain its own concrete existence and a certain independence, which then, as a center of life, encounters the multiplicity of its organs and uses them as mediators with the outer world. We must now ask, what causes the external differentiation of plant organs, which are otherwise identical in terms of their inner principle? How can formative laws, guided by a single formative principle, produce a leaf in one instance and a sepal in another? Since plants exist entirely in the external realm, this differentiation must be based on outer spatial factors. Goethe considered alternating expansion and contraction to be just such factors. When the plant's entelechial principle enters outer existence, working from a point outward, it manifests as a spatial entity. The formative forces are active in space and create organs of a specific spatial form. Now, these forces either concentrate and draw inward to a single point during a stage of contraction, or they spread by unfolding, striving, as it were, to distance themselves from one another during a stage of expansion. Over the course of the plant's life, three expansions alternate with three contractions. these alternating expansion and contraction, this alternating expansion and contraction causes the essentially identical formative forces of the plant to differentiate. Initially, the whole potential of the plant, contracted to a single point, is dormant in the seed, A. It then emerges, unfolds, and expands in the formation of the leaves, C. These are referencing a picture. The formative forces increasingly repel one another. Consequently, the lower leaves appear rudimentary and compact, CC prime. Farther up, they become more ribbed and indented. All that was crowded together begins to diverge, leaves D and E. All that was previously separated by successive intervals, ZZ prime, appears as the formation of the calyx, F, drawn into a single point on the stalk, W. This is the second contraction. In the corolla of the blossom, a new unfolding or expansion takes place. Compared with the sepals, F, of the calyx, the petals, G, are finer and more delicate, which could be caused only by diminishing contraction toward one point, that is, by a greater extension of the formative forces. The next contraction takes place within the reproductive organs, the stamens, H, and the pistil, I. After that, a new expansion begins with the formation of the fruit, K. In the seed, A sub 1, that emerges from the fruit, the whole being of the plant is again condensed to a single point. Footnote, the fruit develops through the growth of the lower part of the pistil, the ovary, L. It represents a later stage of the pistil and can therefore only be drawn separately. The formation of the fruit is the final expansion of the plant. Its life now differentiates itself in an organ that closes itself off from its environment, the fruit and the seed. In the fruit, everything has become appearance. It is outward appearance only, and estranges itself from life to become a dead product. All the essential inner life impulses of the plant are concentrated in the seed, from which a new plant arises. The seed has become almost entirely idea. Its outer appearance has been reduced to a minimum. Rudolf Steiner, end of footnote. The entire plant represents the unfolding or realization of the potential of the bud or seed, which requires only the right outer influences to fully develop as a plant formation. The only difference between a bud and a seed is that the seed requires the earth as its ground, whereas the bud generally represents the formation of a plant upon a plant. The seed represents an individual plant of a higher nature, or a whole cycle of plant formations, so to speak. With each new bud, the plant begins a new phase of its life. It regenerates itself and concentrates its forces to renew them. Consequently, the formation of a bud interrupts the vegetative process. The life of the plant can withdraw into a bud when the conditions for manifest life are lacking, and sprout again when the right conditions reappear. This is why vegetative growth is interrupted during the winter. Goethe spoke of this, quote, "It is very interesting to observe how vegetation continues its vigorous growth when it is not interrupted by severe cold. Here in Italy there are no buds, and one begins to understand what a bud actually is." From Italian Journey, December 2nd, 1786, end of footnote. Excuse me, end of quote. Thus, what in our climate lies hidden in the bud is there openly displayed. Indeed, true plant life lies hidden within it. It lacks only the conditions for its unfolding. Goethe's concept of alternating expansion and contraction has encountered especially strong opposition. All of those attacks, however, stem from a misunderstanding, the belief that these concepts cannot be valid unless a physical cause can be found for them, and unless it is possible to demonstrate the means whereby the inner laws of the plant cause this expansion and contraction. This, however, places the cart before the horse. Nothing should be postulated as the cause of expansion and contraction. On the contrary, everything else follows from them. They themselves cause the progressive metamorphosis, stage by stage. Such misunderstandings arise whenever we fail to apprehend a concept in its own intuitive form. We then insist that it must be the result of an external occurrence. We can think of expansion and contraction only as caused and not as causing. Goethe did not regard expansion and contraction as resulting from inorganic processes in the plant. Rather, he saw them as the way in which the plant's inner entelechial principle shapes itself. Thus, he could not view them as a summation of sense-perceptible processes from which they could be deduced, but was obliged to see them as resulting from the inner unitary principle itself. A plant's life is maintained by its metabolism. There is a fundamental difference between the metabolism of those organs closer to the roots that take in nourishment from the earth, and those receiving nourishment that has passed through other organs. The organs closer to the earth seem to depend directly on their inorganic environment. The other organs, on the other hand, depend on the parts of the organism that precede them. Each succeeding organ thus receives nourishment, especially prepared for it, as it were, by the preceding organs. Nature progresses from seed to fruit in successive stages, so that what follows manifests as the result of what came before. Goethe referred to this step-by-step progression as, quote, progress on a spiritual ladder, close quote. Nothing more than what we have indicated lies in his words, quote, because an upper node arises from the preceding one and receives the juices mediated by it, a node higher on the stem must receive its juices in a finer and more filtered state, and it must benefit from the previous development of the leaves, refine its form, and direct a still finer sap to its leaves and buds. Close quote. We begin to understand all of these things when we see them in the light of Goethe's ideas. The ideas presented here are the elements that lie in the nature of the archetypal plant, in a way that corresponds only to the archetype itself, and not as they manifest in any particular plant, where they do not appear in their original form, but adapted to outer conditions. In animal life, of course, something else intervenes. The life of the animal does not lose itself in its outer features, but separates itself, severs itself from its corporeality, and uses its bodily manifestation only as a tool. It no longer manifests merely as the capacity to shape the organism from within. Rather, it expresses itself within the organism as something beside the organism, acting as its governing force. The animal manifests as a self-contained world, or microcosm, in a much higher sense than does the plant. It has a center that is served by each of its organs. Quote, thus, every mouth is adept at grasping the fodder, fit to the body's need, whether weak and toothless its jaw, or mighty with menacing teeth. In every case, an organ perfectly suited provides for all other organs. Also, each foot and leg, be it a long or a short one, moves to serve with great skill the impulse and need of the creature. From The Metamorphosis of Animals. Close quote. Each organ of the plant contains the whole plant, but the life principle exists nowhere as a definite center. The identity of the organs lies in the fact that they are all formed according to the same laws. In the animal, each organ appears to proceed from this definite center. The center shapes all organs according to its own nature. Thus, the shape of the animal provides the basis for its outer existence, but it is determined from within. The animal's way of life is therefore directed by those same inner formative principles. The inner life of the animal, on the other hand, is free and unrestricted within itself. Within certain limits, it can adapt to outer influences, but it is determined by the inner nature of the type and not by outer mechanistic influences. In other words, adaptation cannot go so far as to cause the organism to appear as a mere product of the outer world. Its formation is restricted within certain limits. Quote, "No God can extend these limits, since they are honored by nature. Perfection was never achieved except through such limitation," from Metamorphosis of Animals. Close quote. If every animal conformed only to the principles of the archetypal animal, all animals would be the same. But the animal organism is differentiated into several organ systems, each of which has the capacity for a certain degree of development. This forms the basis for differentiated evolution. Ideally, they are all equally important, but one system may, nevertheless, predominate and draw the organism's whole store of formative forces to itself and away from the other organs. Such an animal will appear especially developed in the direction of that organ system, whereas another animal will develop in another way. This gives rise to the possibility for the differentiation of the archetypal organism when it enters the phenomenal realm as the various genera and species. The actual factual causes of this differentiation have not been mentioned yet. This is where external factors come into play. Adaptation, through which the organism shapes itself in terms of its outer environment, and the struggle for existence, which allows only those creatures to survive that adapt most successfully to the prevailing conditions. Adaptation and the struggle for existence, however, would have no effect at all upon the organism if its formative principle could not assume diverse forms while maintaining its inner unity. We should not imagine that this principle is influenced by external formative forces in the same way that one inorganic entity affects another. The outer conditions are indeed responsible for the fact that the type assumes a particular form. The form itself, however, is not derived from those outer conditions, but from the inner principle. When explaining the form, we must always consider outer conditions, but we should not think that the form itself results from them. Goethe would have rejected the idea that environmental influences lead to organic forms simply through causality, just as he rejected the teleological principle that explains the form of an organ in terms of an external purpose. In the organ systems of an animal that are related more to its outer structure, the skeleton, for example, we see a law observed in plants appearing again. For example, in the formation of the bones of the skull, footnote, this is a reference to Goethe's vertebral theory of the skull, see pages 39 to 40, editor, end of footnote. Goethe's talent for seeing the inner lawfulness within purely external forms is especially evident here. This distinction between plants and animals, based on Goethe's views, might seem irrelevant, given the fact that recent science has found good reason to doubt that there is any fixed boundary between plants and animals. But even Goethe was aware that it is impossible to establish any such boundary. Footnote, see Goethe's essay on morphology, The Purpose Set Forth, in Goethe's Scientific Studies, Zurkampf edition, page 65, editor, end of footnote. This did not prevent Goethe from clearly defining the plant and the animal. This is related to his worldview as a whole. Goethe assumed that absolutely nothing is constant or fixed in the phenomenal realm, where everything continually fluctuates and moves. The essence of a thing, however, which we grasp in concepts, cannot be derived from fluctuating forms, but from certain intermediate stages in which it can be observed. The way Goethe views the world naturally establishes certain definitions, which, nevertheless, are not rigidly held when we experience particular transitional forms. In fact, this is exactly where Goethe sees the flexibility of natural life. With the ideas described here, Goethe laid the theoretical foundation for organic science. He discovered the essential nature of the organism. It is easy to miss this fact if we assume that the type, the principle that forms itself out of itself, the entelechy, can be explained in terms of something else. But such an assumption is unjustified, because the type, when apprehended intuitively, is self-explanatory. Anyone who has understood this, quote, forming itself according to itself, close quote, of the entelechial principle, will see this as the solution to the mystery of life. Any other solution is impossible, because this is the essence of the matter. If Darwinism is compelled to postulate a primal organism, then we can say that Goethe discovered the essential nature of that primal organism. Footnote: in modern science, the term primal organism usually refers to a primal cell, primal cytoid, a simple entity at the lowest stage of organic evolution. This is a very specific, concrete, sense-perceptible entity. In a Goethean sense, the term primal or archetypal organism does not refer to this, but to the essence, being, or formative entelechial principle that makes the primal cell into an organism. This principle manifests in both the simplest and the most perfected organisms, but developed differently. It is the animality in the animal, and that which makes a living being into an organism. Darwin assumes it from the beginning. It is there, is introduced, and then he says that it reacts one way or another to environmental influences. For Darwin, it was an indefinite X. Goethe wanted to explain this indefinite X. Rudolf Steiner, end of footnote. It was Goethe who broke with merely classifying genera and species and initiated a regeneration of organic science in keeping with the true nature of the organism. Whereas systematizers before Goethe required as many different concepts or ideas as there are externally differentiated species, between which they could find no mediation, Goethe declared all organisms to be the same in idea, differing only in appearance. And he explained why this is so. Thus a philosophical basis was created for a scientific system of organisms. All that remained was to elaborate it. In what sense all existing organisms are only revelations of an idea, and how they reveal it in particular cases, would have to be demonstrated. This great scientific accomplishment was widely acknowledged by the more deeply educated scientists. The younger Edward Joseph Dalton wrote to Goethe on July 6, 1827, it's probably Dalton, I would consider it the most gratifying reward if Your Excellency, to whom natural science is indebted not only for a complete transformation through magnificent perspectives and new views in botany, but also for many first-rate contributions to the field of osteology, were to see in the accompanying pages an endeavor deserving of praise. Close quote. Niels von Esenbeck wrote on June 24, 1820, quote, in your essay, titled An Attempt to Explain the Metamorphosis of Plants, the plant spoke to us about itself for the first time, and in this beautiful humanization captivated me also when I was still young. Close quote. And finally, Voigt on June 6, 1831, quote, with lively interest and humble gratitude, I have received your little book on metamorphosis, which most graciously includes me as an early participant in the history of this theory. It is strange that animal metamorphosis, not the old metamorphosis of insects, but the one that proceeds from the spinal column, has been treated more fairly than plant metamorphosis. Apart from plagiarism and misuse, such quiet recognition may spring from the belief that animal metamorphosis involves less risk. For in the skeleton, the separate bones always remain the same, whereas in botany, metamorphosis threatens to revolutionize the whole terminology, and consequently the identification of species. This frightens the weak, because they do not know where such a thing might lead. Close quote. There's a footnote. Steiner compares Goethe's and Darwin's views from a somewhat different point of view on pages 14 and 15, editor, end of footnote. Here we find complete understanding for Goethe's ideas. There is an awareness that a new way of viewing the individual organism is needed, and that only such a new view should form the foundation for a new scientific system that investigates the particular. The type, which is self-generating, has the capacity to assume endlessly diverse forms as it manifests. Such forms are the objects of our sensory perception, the genera and species of organisms actually living in space and time. To the degree that our mind has understood that general idea, the type, it has also comprehended the entire world of organisms in its unity. When we then see the type as it has taken shape in each particular phenomenal form, those forms become intelligible. They appear as stages, as metamorphoses, in which the type realizes itself. Essentially, the task of the new systematic science, based on Goethe's insights, is to point out these various stages. In both the animal and the plant kingdoms, an ascending evolutionary sequence prevails. Organisms are differentiated by their degree of development. How is this possible? We can characterize the ideal form or type of organisms by the fact that it is made up of spatial and temporal elements. Consequently, it appeared to Goethe as a sensory, supersensory form. It contains spatial-temporal forms that can be perceived as idea, intuitively. When it manifests in the phenomenal realm, the actual sense-perceptible form, now no longer intuitively perceived, may or may not correspond completely to the ideal form. The type may or may not attain its full development. Certain organisms are lower because their phenomenal forms do not correspond fully to the organic type. The more the outer appearance and the organic type coincide in a particular being, the more perfect it is. This is the objective reason for an ascending evolutionary sequence. It is the task of any systematic presentation to investigate this relationship within the form of each organism. When establishing the type, the primal or archetypal organisms, however, this cannot be taken into consideration. One must find a form that represents the most perfected expression of the type. Goethe's archetypal plant provides such a form. Goethe has been criticized for ignoring the world of the cryptogamia in establishing his type. Footnote: cryptogamia are plants that reproduce by spores, producing neither flowers nor seeds, mosses, algae, and ferns, for example. Editor, end of footnote. We have already noted the fact that this must have been a fully conscious decision, because he had also studied such plants. This has objective reasons. Cryptogamia are, in fact, plants in which the archetypal plant manifests only in an extremely one-sided way. They represent the idea of the plant only in a one-sided, sense-perceptible form, and may be assessed according to the established idea. But the idea itself achieves its actual breakthrough only in the phanerogamia. Footnote: phanerogamia are flowering, seed-producing plants. Editor, end of footnote. The important matter here, however, is that Goethe never elaborated his basic thoughts. He did not go deeply enough into the realm of particulars. All his works thus remain fragmentary. A statement in his Italian Journey, September 27, 1786, shows that he also intended to clarify this realm, and that his ideas would make it possible, quote, to truly determine genera and species, which until now, I think, has occurred only in a very arbitrary way, close quote. He did not follow through with this intention by presenting in any concerted way the connection between his general ideas and the world of particulars, the reality of specific forms. This he himself regarded as a deficiency in his fragments, to which he referred when writing to J. F. Sorret, June 28, 1828, about De Candela. Quote, "I also see, with increasing clarity, how he regards the intentions with which I continue to live and which are expressed clearly enough in my little essay about metamorphosis, but whose connection with empirical botany, as I have long known, does not emerge clearly enough. It seems also, close quote, it seems also that this is why Goethe's views have been so misunderstood. They were misunderstood simply because they were not understood at all. Goethe's ideas also provide a conceptual explanation for a discovery by Darwin and Haeckel that the development of an individual, ontogeny, represents a repetition of its entire evolution, phylogeny. After all, what Haeckel presents here must be considered no more than an unexplained fact, that is, the fact that each individual passes in an abbreviated way through all the developmental stages described by paleontology as individual organic forms. Haeckel and his followers attributed this to the law of heredity, but that law itself is only an abbreviated expression of this fact. The explanation is that the various paleontological forms, as well as any living individuals, are all manifestations of a single archetype, which, over successive periods of time, unfolds the formative forces that lie within it as potential. Each higher individual is, in fact, more perfected because favorable environmental influences allow it to develop freely according to its inner nature. If, on the other hand, various influences force an individual to remain at a lower stage, only some of its inner forces will manifest, and what thus manifests as a whole would comprise only a part of the more highly developed organism. In this way, the developing higher organism appears to be composed of lower organisms, or by the same token, the lower organisms appear in their development as parts of the higher. We can therefore discern in the development of a higher animal the development of all the lower ones, Haeckel's biogenetic law. A physicist is unsatisfied with merely stating and describing the facts, and searches instead for the laws that govern them, for the ideas of the phenomena. Similarly, those who wish to penetrate the nature of living beings find it unsatisfying simply to cite facts of kinship, heredity, the struggle for existence, and so on. They will want to know the ideas that underlie those things. This is what Goethe was striving for. His thoughts regarding the type are, to the organic scientist, what Kepler's three laws are to the physicist. Without such laws, we would experience the world as a mere labyrinth of facts. This has frequently been misunderstood. Some insist that Goethe's idea of metamorphosis is merely an image that arises abstractly in our intellect, that he did not realize that the concept of leaves transforming into the organs of the blossom is meaningful only if these organs, the stamens, for example, had once actually been leaves. But this turns Goethe's view on its head. It makes one sense-perceptible organ primary in principle, and derives the other organ from it in a literal way. Goethe never intended it that way. For him, the organ that arises first chronologically is not at all primary in terms of the idea or principle. Stamens are not related to leaves because they were once actual leaves. No, it is because they are related to in principle, through their inner nature, that they once appeared as leaves. The sense-perceptible transformation is the result of their ideal relationship, not the other way round. It has now been established empirically that all the lateral organs of the plant are identical. But why are they considered identical? According to Schleiden, it is because they all develop on the stem as lateral protuberances and are pushed outward so that the lateral cell formation continues near the stem and no new cells are formed at the tip that was first to emerge. This purely external relationship forms the basis of the idea of identity. Again, according to Goethe, the matter is different. The lateral organs are identical in their ideal, essential nature. Therefore, they also manifest outwardly as identical formations. According to him, the relatedness that appears to the senses is a result of an inner, ideal connection. Goethe's perspective differs from the materialistic view because of the way it frames its questions. They do not contradict, but complement each other. Goethe's ideas provide the basis for the materialistic view. Goethe's ideas are more than poetic prophecies of later discoveries. They are independent, theoretical discoveries whose value has only begun to be recognized, and from which science will continue to draw sustenance for a long time to come. The particular empirical facts that Goethe used may be superseded, even disproved to some degree by more exact and detailed research. But the ideas he established will always remain fundamental to organic science, because they are independent of those empirical facts. Just as every newly discovered planet must orbit its star according to Kepler's laws, every process in organic nature must accord with Goethe's ideas. Events in the starry heavens were known long before Kepler and Copernicus, but these men were the first to discover their laws. Organic nature was observed long before Goethe, but he discovered its laws. Goethe is the Copernicus and Kepler of the organic world. The nature of Goethe's theory can also be explained in the following way. Besides ordinary, empirical, purely fact-gathering mechanics, there is also a rational mechanics that derives a priori laws from the inner nature of fundamental mechanical principles. Empirical mechanics relates to its rational counterpart in the same way that the theories of Darwin, Haeckel, and so on relate to Goethe's rational organic science. Initially, Goethe was not clear about this aspect of his theory, but later he expressed it very emphatically. Thus, he wrote to H. W. F. Wackenroder, quote, "Continue to acquaint me with everything that interests you. Somewhere it will connect with my observations." Close quote from January 21, 1832. Which is to say that he had discovered the fundamental principles of organic science, from which it should be possible to deduce everything else. Earlier, however, all this had been working unconsciously in Goethe's mind, and he approached the facts accordingly. It only became conscious to him through his first conversation about science with Schiller, which we will describe later. Schiller immediately recognized the ideal nature of Goethe's archetypal plant, and claimed that external reality could never be fully consistent with it. This stimulated Goethe to think about the relationship between what he called the type and empirical reality. He now encountered one of the most significant problems in all of human research. What is the relationship between idea and external reality, between thinking and experience? It became increasingly clear to him that no individual empirical object corresponds fully to his type. There is nothing in nature that is identical to it. The concept of the type cannot, therefore, stem from the sensory world as such, even though it is acquired through the encounter with the sensory world. Consequently, it can only arise from the type itself. The idea of the archetypal being must, by virtue of an inner necessity, develop its content out of itself, which then appears in the phenomenal world in another form, as a percept. It is interesting in this regard to see how Goethe upheld the validity of experience and strictly separated idea and object, even in his encounters with empirical scientists. In 1796, Sommering sent him a book in which he had attempted to discover the seat of the soul. In a letter to Sommering, August 28, 1796, Goethe found that he had woven too much metaphysics into his views. He said that an idea about objects of experience has no justification if it goes beyond them and is not based on the essential nature of the objects themselves. He maintained that when dealing with objects of experience, the idea is an organ for apprehending the necessary interrelationships of phenomena that would otherwise be perceived blindly as random occurrences in space and time. Because the idea may not add anything new to the object, it follows that the object, in its actual essence, is of an ideal nature. In fact, all of empirical reality must have two sides, one through which it is of a particular individual nature, and another through which it is of an ideal, universal nature. Goethe's association with the philosophers of his time and their works allowed him a number of perspectives on this question. He was stimulated by Schelling's title On the World's Soul and his first, quote, Outline for a System of Natural Science. See Goethe's Annals, 1798-1799. And Heinrich Steffen's title Fundamentals of Philosophical Natural Science. He also discussed many questions with Hegel. All this finally led Goethe to again study the work of Kant, which he had done before at Schiller's urging. In 1817, see his Annals, he assessed how years of studying Kant had influenced his ideas about nature and natural phenomena. These reflections led to the following essays, in which Goethe addresses the most central questions of science: Fortunate Encounter, Judgment through Intuitive Perception, Reconsideration and Resignation, The Formative Impulse, The Enterprise Justified, The Purpose Set Forth, The Content Prefaced, History of My Botanical Studies, The Origin of the Essay on the Metamorphosis of Plants. These essays all express the thought mentioned, that every object has two sides, the immediate one of its appearance, phenomenal form, and the second containing its essence, or being. Goethe thus came to the only satisfactory view of nature, and it laid the foundation for the one truly objective method. Any theory that views the idea as alien to the object itself, as merely subjective, cannot claim true objectivity if it uses ideas at all. Goethe, on the other hand, can claim to add nothing that does not already lie within the object. Goethe also pursued the detailed, factual aspect of those branches of science to which his ideas related. In 1795, he attended Loder's lectures on the ligaments, and throughout that period he kept anatomy and physiology in view. This is all the more significant because he was writing his lectures on osteology at the time. In 1796, he experimented with growing plants in the dark and under colored glass. Later, he also studied insect metamorphosis. Goethe was also stimulated by philologist F. A. Wolff, who called Goethe's attention to Wolff, with two F's, his namesake, who, already in 1759, in his Theoria Generationis, had had expressed ideas similar to those of Goethe on the metamorphosis of plants. This led Goethe to study Wolff more closely during 1807. Later, however, he discovered that Wolff, despite his acuity, was not clear on the essential questions. He had not yet conceived of the type as an entity imperceptible to the senses, developing its content purely out of inner necessity. He still viewed the plant as an outer, mechanical complex of individual details. This interaction with his many scientist friends and his happiness at being recognized and emulated by numerous kindred spirits led Goethe in 1807 to consider publishing the fragments of scientific works he had withheld thus far. He gradually abandoned the idea of writing a larger scientific work, but he did not get around to publishing his individual essays that year. His interest in the theory of color again pushed morphology into the background for a while. The first booklet of his essays was not published for another 10 years, and by 1824 two volumes had been published, the first in four booklets and the second in two. In addition to the essays on his own views, we find discussions of significant literary publications on morphology, as well as the treatises of other scholars, whose presentations, nevertheless, always complement Goethe's interpretation of nature in some way. Twice, again, Goethe was challenged to take up natural science more intensively. Both instances involved significant scientific publications that were intimately connected with Goethe's own work. The first was stimulated by works on the spiral tendency in plants by botanist Carl Friedrich Philipp von Martius, 1794 to 1868. The second by a scientific dispute in the French Academy of Sciences. Martius saw the plant's form in its development as a combination of a spiral and a vertical tendency. The vertical tendency leads it to grow in line with the root and stem. The spiral tendency is revealed by the spreading leaves, blossom, and so on. Goethe saw in this thought only an elaboration that emphasizes the spatial, parenthesis, vertical and spiral, close parenthesis, aspects of his own ideas, which had been established in 1790 with his essay on metamorphosis. We refer here to our comments on Goethe's quote on the spiral tendency of vegetation, close quote, which make it clear that Goethe did not, in this essay, present anything essentially new in relation to his earlier ideas. We emphasize this especially for those who say they see a regression in Goethe's essay from his earlier clear views to the, quote, deepest depths of mysticism, close quote. At a very advanced age, Goethe finished two more essays, 1830 to 1832, on the dispute between French scientists Georg Baron von Cuvier and Étienne Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire. Sorry about the French. These essays contain the principles of Goethe's view of nature, again assembled with striking conciseness. Cuvier was an empiricist of the old school. He sought appropriate individual concepts for each animal species. He believed that within the conceptual edifice of his system of organic nature, he had to include as many types as there are various animal species displayed in nature. But these types stood side by side without any mediation whatsoever. He disregarded the fact that those who strive for knowledge are not satisfied with the particular as such, confronting us in its immediate phenomenal form. But because we approach an object in the sensory world with the intention to know it, we should not assume that we are unsatisfied with the particular because we lack the capacity for knowledge. Rather, the object itself must contain the reason for our dissatisfaction. The nature of the particular is by no means exhausted in this its particularity. As we strive to understand it, we are urged not toward anything particular, but something general. This general idea is the real being, the essence of all that exists as particular. Its particularity is only one side of its existence. Its other aspect is the general, or the type. Footnote, Goethe states, quote, "The fundamental characteristic of a living whole, to separate, to unite, to merge into the universal, to abide in the particular, to self-transform, to specify itself, and, because living things tend to manifest under a thousand conditions, to come forward and to vanish, to solidify and melt, to rigidify and flow, to expand and contract. Since all these effects occur simultaneously, any or all may occur at the same moment. Growth and decay, creation and destruction, birth and death, joy and sorrow, are all interwoven in the same sense and in the same measure. Therefore, even the most particular thing that occurs always appears as a picture and parable for the most universal." Close quote, Verses in Prose, editor, end of footnote. This should be understood when referring to the particular as a form of the general. Because the general idea is the true being, or essence of the particular, it is impossible to deduce or abstract it from the particular. Because the general cannot borrow its essence from anywhere else, it must provide its own. Thus the nature of the general type is such that its essence and form are identical. Consequently, it can be comprehended only as a whole, independent of the particular. Science has the task of showing how each particular, by adhering to its own nature, relates to the general idea. In this way, particular kinds of existence enter the cognitive realm, where we recognize their mutual determination and interdependency. Things that would otherwise be perceived only in a dissociated way, as isolated entities in space and time, may now be seen in their necessary lawful interrelatedness. Cuvier, however, flatly rejected this view, which Geoffrey St. Hilaire maintained. This is, in fact, the aspect of their dispute that Goethe was interested in. This question has often been distorted by recent views that show the facts in a very different light than is the case when one approaches them without bias. Geoffrey St. Hilaire's arguments were based not only on his own research, but on the work of a number of like-minded German scientists, among whom he mentions Goethe. Goethe was extraordinarily interested in this matter, and was deeply pleased to find a comrade in Geoffrey St. Hilaire. On August 2, 1830, he said to Eckermann, quote, "Geoffrey St. Hilaire is now definitely on our side, and with him all his important students and followers in France. For me, this is an event of incredible value, and I rightly rejoice over the final victory of a cause to which I have devoted my life, and which, in a very special sense, is also my own." Close quote. It is indeed a remarkable phenomenon that in Germany the positive response to Goethe's research was mainly among philosophers, but less among scientists. Whereas in France the positive response came from scientists. Augustin Pirard de Candolle gave utmost attention to Goethe's theory of metamorphosis, and his approach to botany was close to Goethe's own. Goethe's Metamorphosis Essay, 1790 edition, had already been translated into French by Gingin's Lazarus. Under such circumstances, Goethe was right to hope that a French translation of his botanical writings, if done with his collaboration, would not fall on barren ground. In 1831, with Goethe's constant assistance, that translation was produced by Friedrich Jakob Soret. It was published in French, with the original German on facing pages. It contained that first, in quotes, attempt of 1790, as well as the history of Goethe's botanical studies, the effect of his theory on his contemporaries, and something on De Candolle. The end of chapter 4.